Welcome to a discussion of a very controversial, knotty subject that I'm sure to most people seems to be a conflict that appears unsolvable, almost a kind of situation which seems doomed to perpetuate for years and years to come. After all, it has been going on now for nearly 50 years on and off. What I hope to do within the next four sessions, there's four sessions, is to do a little history so that perhaps all of us who are not really quite sure about how things came to be will have a little better idea of who did what, when, to whom, and then also talk a bit about the psychological manifestations of this conflict, because the more I have seen it and the more I have been involved in it, it seems as though certainly the political problems are huge, but the psychological problems are even as large. Let me introduce myself to you first. My name is Carol Berkland, and I am the what we call the Area Secretary for the Middle East and East Africa of the World Mission Division of the ELCA, which has its new offices in Chicago, Illinois, on Higgins Road. My association with this topic, or with this conflict, goes back about 10 years it goes back even further than that. I think probably I was about 16 years old when I read that very famous book, Exodus, which I assume many of you have read and was probably the introduction to many of you to this conflict. That book, as time went on, I realized leaves a lot to be desired, and please don't use it as any kind of normative text for the conflict, because it was written by someone who had certainly a lot of feelings on one side of the issue, Leonoris, who is Jewish, and wrote much of the fantasies rather than the realities of that situation. But from the time I was about 16, I was fascinated with this whole issue of the Jews returning to Israel, and hoped sometime in my life to be able to visit Israel. That time came for me in 1977 when I made my first trip to Israel. It was a short trip, but I was extremely excited about being there, and must tell you honestly that I looked at this conflict totally through the eyes of the Jewish perspective, simply because that had been my history, because of my relationships with people there. At that point in 1977, I did not know any Palestinian people. And I can remember having some very spirited arguments with some other folks who were at that point even trying to tell me that there was another side to the story. But I had heard so much of the Jewish side that I really didn't want to hear the Arab side. I felt that the Arabs had made huge mistakes in the past, that in a sense, because they did not take advantage of the UN partition in 1947, they had attacked Israel, that they really, in a sense, deserved everything that they had gotten, and that they were a rather pathetic people who had unfortunately suffered from a lack of bad leadership and certainly a lack of foresight. They always seemed to be trying to make peace after the fact, after they had missed yet another opportunity. So I believed all of that kind of, in a sense, anti-Arab propaganda about the situation. Then in 1978, I went back to Israel with my husband, and we lived in a kibbutz, which is a communal farm. I think you know what that means. It's a very interesting way of life where people live in a community, and there is supposedly no private property. Now the situation has changed somewhat, but in the early days, everything was shared communally. People ate in the communal dining room, et cetera, et cetera. Children were raised in children's houses. And we lived there for about 4 months, 4 to 5 months, working as volunteers. And again, this was an experience that really not necessarily confirmed what I thought about the situation in the past, but certainly, again, shielded me from seeing Palestinian side of the story. It was not until 1979 when I began my work with the Old American Lutheran Church in the Global Mission Division there that my work brought me in contact with Palestinian Christians. And through those relationships, I did then begin to see that there were two sides to the story, that both sides, both the Jews and the Palestinians, had really been cast in what you could call a tragic history, one that seemed almost inevitable because of historical circumstance. And I began to not only certainly had Jewish friends, Israeli friends in the past, but I began to have Palestinian friends as well. All of that rather culminated in the summer of 1986 when, after I had won a fellowship to study at the Graduate School of Ecumenical Studies outside of Geneva, I had planned to do a project, some kind of a project at the World Council of Churches that had something to do with the Middle East. I didn't exactly know what that was, but after some consultation with people at the World Council, we decided that so much had been said about this issue that was rather impersonal history or impersonal sociological statistics, what have you. And we felt that there was certainly a human face behind this conflict. We wanted as much as possible to allow both Jews and Palestinians to talk about their lives, to talk about their histories, their fears, their hopes, what it was like for them to live in this situation where day in, day out, it was a struggle to remain human in really an inhumane situation. That summer, I went to Israel and the West Bank and interviewed about 19 Israelis and Palestinians. The result of that is a book that is now over in the bookstore called Unified in Hope, Arab and Jews Talk About Peace. I think, obviously, I have a great deal of emotion involved in this, but I think that book is will help anyone to see that, in fact, this is a conflict involving people, and that, unfortunately, in the past, both peoples, both the Israelis and Palestinians, have really used stereotypes, have tended to deal with each other in stereotypical images. In a sense, they needed those images, because if they had not had the images, they would be forced to deal with each other as human beings, and that might have, in fact, caused a lot of the preconceived notions that they had about each other to they would have had to find out that those notions were false. Anyway, whenever we discuss this topic, usually everyone brings to it a certain set of historical views, a lot of emotion. Goodness knows the people who were involved in it are very emotional. They're emotional because both sides really believe that the ultimate solution to the conflict will probably determine whether they live or die. So that explains their degree of emotion. We are emotional as well because of what we have been told or what we feel or any number of things. I guess I would only ask of you as we discuss this, and I really want us to discuss it. I think this is a perfect opportunity for you to ask questions, anything that you've ever really wanted to know about this situation. I'm not saying that I am the greatest expert about this this situation, but I have been relating to it rather closely for the last 10 years. So I really look forward to the chance of answering your questions and trying to make the situation a little clearer than it may have been to you in the past. I would only ask of you that you come with an attitude to learn, and that perhaps some of the ideas you have had in the past you will find are not as true as you thought they were. We should feel all free to express our opinions freely. Nobody's going to jump on you if you disagree with somebody else here. I think the only way you can learn is have the chance to honestly express your feelings, and then we can talk about the situation. Yes?
I don't have a question, but I have a statement. I don't know if anybody knows Pastor Siegel, but he was traveling back in 58, and he visited with the president of the American University in Beirut.
Mm-hmm.
And that president, I don't remember his name, he told Pastor Siegel there was going to be nothing but trouble if they continued and to take away the Palestinians' homes and the course they were taking.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 58.
Well, there are a lot of people who said that in 58, and a number of people who said that even before 58.
And I still remember that.
Yeah.
Nowadays.
Yeah. Again, please feel free to ask questions as I go along. I'll stop every once in a while to ask if someone does have a specific question or if you have a comment to make. I find that sometimes, since I am not a professional teacher, I do a little better when people ask me questions. I think of things that perhaps I should have said that I've forgotten. So, anyway, what we'll do today is look at the uprising, which most of you have become quite familiar with. It's been on your television screens now, certainly more in the beginning when it started in December of 1987. Now we see less of it, but it is still going on. In fact, I think we have now passed the point of about, 520 casualties. I've been away from the newspapers for the last week, so I don't know what the count is now. About 515 Palestinians have been killed, and I think perhaps somewhere between 17 and 20 Israelis have been killed as the result of the uprising. Let's look, first of all, let's do a little geography lesson. That maybe will help us put things a bit in perspective. I've brought along a map here showing you the areas that we're going to be talking about. When we talk about Israel, we're talking about this area here, everything but this area, which is called the West Bank. Called the West Bank because it's the West Bank of the Jordan River, essentially. This area here, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip down here, were areas that have been occupied by Israel since 1967. You recall the Six-Day War. Israel took all of this area, in fact, probably went even further across the Jordan, took the Golan Heights up here, went into the Sinai, and took all of the Sinai. The Sinai, of course, as you recall, was returned during the Israeli-Egyptian peace with Anwar Sadat. Within this area, these two areas, which are called the occupied territories, religious Jews use the biblical terms Judea and Samaria. It's very interesting. The more you get into this topic, you realize that everything is political. Everything has political overtones. And those political overtones are certainly involved in language. You can tell if some Israeli mentions the occupied territories, you'll know, this Israeli is on the left of the political spectrum. He or she is probably a person who would be willing to trade this territory for peace. If, on the other hand, you hear someone talk about Judea and Samaria, that also sets off a light bulb in your mind, and that tells you, here's a person who was probably a religious nationalist. Maybe he or she's even a settler on the West Bank and believes that since God gave the Jewish people all of this area to be theirs, that we cannot ever return it. So again, language is very political. It's interesting to see, we should first talk about how big this area is. All of Israel, Sinai, Jordan, Syria, etc., Lebanon. It's a very, very small area. Israel itself and the West Bank, I have heard about the same area as Wales, and you know how small that is. We're not talking about something very big. You can drive from down here at Eilat all the way up to the northern part of Israel, certainly in one day. It's about 210 miles long, and here at the narrowest spot between Herzliya and the occupied West Bank, that's only 10 miles wide. Some Israelis, of course, have said that it's necessary to hold on to the West Bank, not just simply because of religious reasons, because God has given us this territory, but also because of security reasons. They say there's no way that we can live with a hostile population on our borders in an area where the country is only 10 miles wide. It's interesting that a lot of times when there are official visitors, government visitors who come to Israel, one of the first places they take them is into the West Bank to see how close, how small everything really is. So it's a very small area. In terms of the population, in Israel there are both Jews and Arabs. This is a result, of course, of the fact that Arabs have always been living in this part of the world for literally thousands of years. And when the Zionist pioneers started coming to Israel before the turn of the century and certainly after, they found a great Arab majority. There were a lot of, many, many hundreds of thousands of Arabs living there. Through certainly the first war in 1948, the War of Independence, when so many Arabs fled into Jordan and into the West Bank, those numbers have changed from time to time. The main reason why Jews came back to this part of the world was to have a Jewish state, to live in an area where they would live as a majority. But it's always been difficult because of this huge Arab population. Right now in Israel there are about 3,300,000 Jewish citizens. There are about 650,000 Arab citizens. These are Arabs who, during the 1948 war, did not leave. They stayed on. In the West Bank in Gaza, you have about 80,000 Jewish settlers who, since 1967, have moved into the West Bank and started basically residential settlements. A lot of these people went to the West Bank simply because of... Do you have a question? Yeah.
Just about when you mention Arab citizens, do they have full rights of citizenship?
Yes, I'm sorry, that's good. I'm glad you asked the question. Okay. Yes, they do have full rights in the sense that they are allowed to vote. There are certainly Israeli Arabs sitting in the Knesset, which is the parliament of Israel. And the Israelis, of course, are very proud of saying that, look, we are the only democracy in the Middle East. The Arab minority has representatives in our parliament and can vote in this and that. And in that sense, they're absolutely right. In the real sense, Arabs do enjoy a second-class citizen status. And one of the reasons that they are second-class citizens is that so much of life in Israel is related to service in the army. Every able-bodied man serves in the Israeli army. I think that they start at about 18 after they finish high school. Just everybody goes in, and they spend 3 years on active duty, and then up until their 50s, until they're in their 50s, they go 6 weeks to reserve duty. And now, because of the uprising has started, that 6 weeks has been doubled. So you have, it's incredible to think about, but every able-bodied man in Israel up until, I think, 55 or so, is now spending perhaps 3 months of the year serving in the army because of the necessity to try to exert control over the West Bank.
So it crosses economic lines?
Pardon?
Nothing to do with being a rich person or a poor person there.
The service in the army?
Yeah.
No, everybody does it. It's so much a part of Israeli life. Social benefits are tied to service in the army. If you're a veteran, if you're an army veteran, you get certain loans for education. You get low interest loans for housing when you go to buy your first house to get a better loan. And of course, because the Arabs are seen as a security risk, even though they are citizens of the state, they are not allowed to serve in the military. And in that sense, they suffer both economically and also socially, because they're seen by the men and people who do go into the army as kind of, leeches on the state or whatever. You know, these people aren't really pulling their weight, but there's nothing they can do because they're prevented from serving. Yes?
Are the women conscripted in the Army also?
Yes, they do. They only serve for 2 years, however, and there's no reserve duty for them. And they are not in combat. They're in other kinds of situations. But yes, every young woman, unless, I'm sorry, I forgot one thing. Unless you are religious, meaning if you're studying in a yeshiva or something like that, that this really violates your religious principles, then you don't have to go to the Army.
Men and women?
Men and women, but especially women. It's more difficult for a man to not serve in the Army because of religious principles than it is for a woman. Right. Okay. About 80,000 of these West Bank settlers who are living there in, as I said, not agricultural settlements, but usually just bedroom communities, so to speak. Since this area is so small, almost anyone living anywhere in the West Bank, if they have a job in Jerusalem or if they have a job in Tel Aviv, they commute to their jobs from these settlements. The settlements were subsidized by the government. A lot of people moved there not particularly for religious reasons, though there were those who felt that they should move there because, as I said again, God had given us the land and therefore we should have a presence on the land for religious, nationalist reasons. But a lot of them just moved there because it was easier to get an apartment. Housing in Israel proper and within what we call here the Green Line is quite expensive and it's hard to find. And you know, if you have a choice between living in a crowded apartment in Jerusalem or going out and living in the West Bank and having a nicer new flat that has a good mortgage rate, you're going to do that. So there are about 80,000 of these settlers. About 2,000 settlers are in Gaza, but these people are mostly in agricultural settlements. They're not bedroom communities because there's nothing around here close enough to commute to work. And also it's more dangerous to live in Gaza, but we'll talk about that later. In the West Bank, there are about 700,000 Arabs who are here, and about 650,000 Arabs in the Gaza Strip there. So when you get the total in all areas, Jews about 3,382,000, Arabs about 2 million. So you're seeing that the numbers of Arabs and Jews are getting rather close. The birth rate of the Arabs is much higher than the Jewish birth rate. And especially in Gaza, it is not at all, you see families of 10, 12 children. That's the way things go. And in fact, it's become, the women have begun to see it as rather a patriotic duty to have as many children as possible, because they know these numbers, and so they see it as a nationalist duty to have as many children as possible. Here within Israel, the percentage of the Arab minority is about 18% of the total population now, but because of the birth rate, they think by the year 2000 it will again increased to about 23,000. Let us say that the religious nationalists, the right-wing people who say that Israel, the land of Israel, is all of this territory, let us say that they have their way, and therefore all of this territory is annexed, it becomes Israel. Then you would have, by the year 2000, a population of about 45% to 50% would be Arabs, Palestinians. So that's a very interesting number, because of course if the reason that you have come back to Palestine to form or found a Jewish state where Jews will be the minority or the majority in the country, then you find yourself in a situation where potentially you have 50% of the population not being Jewish. And the question then is, do you continue to have Israel being a democratic country? If you do, then what will eventually happen is that you will have a majority of Arabs voting, you'll have a majority of Arabs in the Knesset, and you will not
any longer have a majority of Jews in Israel. So it will no longer be a Jewish state. A lot of people point to this, they call this the demographic problem. Some people call it the demographic time bomb. And it is one of the major arguments used against Jews who would like to annex all this territory. They say, look, we can't do this, because if we do it, we're not going to have a Jewish state anymore. We'll not have a place where Jews will be a majority. Are there any questions about that? Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about the uprising. What is it? Well, it is a grassroots uprising against 20 years of Israeli military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. The Arabs have given it an Arabic name, which is pronounced Intifada, and that means, the translation is, a shaking off, as one would shake off, let's see, a mosquito or something, or an insect, something that was bothering you, something you want to get rid of. And again, when you talk to Palestinians, they say, we just want to get rid of this occupation. We are tired, we are fed up of living under 20 years of Israeli military occupation. I think in order to understand the uprising, you have to understand what life is like in the Gaza Strip. Gaza is a very small area with a huge population of people. Here, at the widest part, down in the south, it's about 6 miles wide, 6 to 9 miles wide, about 25 miles long, and within that area live a population of 650,000 people. Some say that the density of population in the Gaza Strip is nearly as dense as Hong Kong. And after having visited it a couple of times, I can tell you that it is quite amazing, especially in the refugee camps. Of the 650,000 inhabitants, Arab inhabitants of the Gaza Strip, about 430,000 of them are refugees, meaning they are registered as refugees. How did they get there? That's a very good question. And it is basically a result of the 1948 war for independence. Most of the refugees who were now living in Gaza lived up here along the coast in places like Ashkelon and Ashdod, though some of them lived as far north as Haifa. But they were basically in this area. Certainly there were Arabs already living in Gaza. Gaza had been and continues to be an area of agriculture, a lot of citrus growing. Basically that was the crop, it was an agriculturally based economy. When it became obvious in 1947 that there was going to be a war, the residents of a lot of these areas, Arab residents, left. And they left for a couple of reasons. There's always been a controversy about this, whether the Arabs were forced out by the Jews or whether they simply left on their own accord. It's a little bit of both. Certainly, they thought that the Egyptian army was coming up the coast here through Gaza and through this area, and in fact, that's exactly what happened. And like people everywhere, if there's an army coming, you want to get out of the way. You don't want to be in the middle of fighting, and that's what happened all over during this during the war. A lot of people left because they just were afraid. They packed up what they could put on their backs, and they got out of there. In some cases, there was a systematic plan of driving the Arab population out, but that was more up in the northern, around the Jerusalem area. People went to Gaza because, for a couple of reasons. One is that they had relatives there, and they also felt that when the winter was coming, they wanted to have a place where it would be warm. If you don't happen to have a roof over your head, if you become a refugee, you want to go somewhere where at least you think it's going to be warm in the wintertime. It can be really cold
in some parts of Israel, the cold is, or the winter is very wet and rainy. So they settled down here where they thought it would be warm. When the armistice lines were drawn, that is, after these people had been uprooted or had left and gone to Gaza, then the armistice lines were drawn in 1948. Egypt then had control of Gaza and had control of it up until 1967 when the Israelis took it as part of the 67 war. The Israelis point out the fact that life under the Egyptians was probably as bad or worse than it was under the Israelis, and they may not be wrong. Certainly during the time between 48 and 67, very little was done for the refugees. They sat in tents, they sat in really terrible conditions. The United Nations came in and organized a group, an organization called UNRWA, which is United Nations Refugees and Works Program for Palestinian Refugees. They set up schools, they set up hospitals to try to make life a little better for these 430-some thousand people. And of course, they did what they could do, but it was still a miserable existence. That continued on even after 1967 when the Israelis took over the Gaza Strip. To some extent, the Israelis tried to make life a little better, but again, it's if you were to go into Gaza and really try to improve the lives of these people, you would have to spend incredible amounts of money. And let's face it, the Israelis neither had the money nor did they particularly have the will. They kept saying during all these years, look, this is an Arab problem. Why don't the surrounding Arab governments do something about it? And the fact is that they didn't and nobody did. It was basically the United Nations that took care of the refugee problem. Life as a refugee in Gaza is really miserable. It's miserable basically because you are living in what could be called nothing more than a prison. A lot of people don't know it, but the Gaza Strip is surrounded by barbed wire. There's one exit down at the southern part into Egypt, and then one exit at the northern part up into Israel. And they're very heavily guarded. Every day, about 60,000 Gazans leave from this northern end to go up into Israel to work. They hold jobs as garbage collectors, dishwashers, people who work on construction sites. Some of them have regular jobs, meaning that they have a regular job to go to every day. But many of them are just simply laborers who get in cars very early in the morning. They have to leave the Gaza Strip at about 4 o'clock in the morning. There are tremendous traffic jams at the northern end of the Gaza Strip as all of these 60,000 people try to get transportation up into Israel. Because by law, if they are caught in Israel after midnight, they can be arrested. Some of them get around that. Some of the Israeli employers get around that rule by providing overnight accommodations, let's say on a construction site or something. They just construct a place where they can, four or five, six Palestinians can sleep, so they don't have to make the trip back and forth every day. But most of them have to be back in Gaza, so it's a very long work day. If you can imagine getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and getting a ride and then going up to Tel Aviv and standing on a street corner hoping to get a job, sometimes you come back with nothing. You don't get anything. You may get picked up and somebody wants you to come and wash dishes in their restaurant, and you'll stand on your feet from maybe 10 o'clock in the morning until before you have to go back, and you're paid $10 a day for your work. Yes?
Were those, some of them professional people?
Yes, you see, that's the other part that's a very frustrating thing. The Palestinians, by and large, are an extremely well-educated people, and they put great value on education. certainly it's more difficult to get an education as a Palestinian refugee than, let's say, you are in the West Bank, where there are three or four universities. But still, there are people in Gaza who have university degrees, and there is no work for them. So they end up doing very humiliating kinds of things in terms of being treated like they're stupid and foolish and just a dishwasher, construction worker, when some of them may even have a university degree.
Yeah. Can they leave and go live somewhere else?
Yes, they can, and the Israelis are very happy if they do leave, because that just means that there's one less problem. But of course, you have to. The only way to leave is if you have connections somewhere else. If you have connections in other countries, or part of your family has immigrated before, there seems to be much more of a movement out from the West Bank than from Gaza, because people in the West Bank tend to be much better off than the refugees. Many of them have family members who have already left for the United States, and right now, at least, if you have an uncle or a cousin or somebody living in Detroit, and the situation is as bad as it is in the West Bank, you'll probably take the opportunity to leave if you can. But a lot of people also don't want to leave if they have property and family, and after all, this is their home, and it's difficult for them to think about leaving it. I guess it's probably the sense of hopelessness that you see in the camps. If you're a younger person, say 10, 12, 13 years old, you can go to school. There is something for you to do. If you're a woman, you have enormous responsibilities in kind of organizing a household of 9 or 10 children, so that kind of keeps you going. But for the men who are in their 20s and 30s, who of course may have sat and watched their father sit idly by for years and years, there's just a tremendous feeling of hopelessness that your life is not going to get any better. The Israelis are there. They show no indication of leaving. And I think it must be a terribly depressing situation to try to live there day in and day out. And of course, it also gives you a lot of time on your hands. It gives you time on your hands to think about how bad your situation is and really how little hope there is of improving it.
I was going to ask, well, does Arafat want to help, or is he just, it seems to me he's just looking out for himself, you know, politically and that. I don't.
Yeah, well, what we're going to do is we'll have one session, probably the last session on Friday, where I talk a lot about Arafat and the PLO. So that'll give you a lot of background to find out exactly who he is and the whole history of that.
Because I was wondering what the professional and the better Palestinians think of him.
He's still their leader. They acknowledge him as their leader. They think very highly of him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, but we can talk about that later.
Okay.
Let's see. How did this all begin? It was very interesting. I was in Gaza in the latter part of November of 1987, and I must tell you, it was certainly a distressing thing to see, because I had not seen the refugee camps before. But it was also very peaceful. I can remember sitting, having lunch, looking out over the ocean, the Mediterranean there, which is beautiful. There are a lot of people who, you have to go to Gaza to realize there are terribly bad parts of it, but there are also very beautiful parts. I traveled all from the north all the way down to the south, and there are places along the Mediterranean that are absolutely beautiful and give you the feeling that if the Israelis and Palestinians could ever come to some kind of an agreement, that they could develop that area into a vacation spot that would rival the south of France. It's absolutely beautiful. But there seemed to be no indication that anything violent was about to happen, though there had been an increase of violent incidences in the past year, and there were a lot of people in Israel saying, look, you know, we better worry about the situation because it's not getting any better, and it seems as though it's a type of situation that could explode at any time. Well, it did explode. It exploded the first week in December of 1987. What happened was, as I said, there are 2,000 Jewish settlers in Gaza, in these agricultural settlements. And there would be violent incidences, stones thrown at settlers' cars. Well, in this case, a settler was stabbed to death in Gaza City. That had happened about 4 or 5 days before. Then the next thing that happened was a van load of these Palestinian workers who, as I said, go into to Israel to work, was rammed by a Jewish truck or something, some kind of Jewish vehicle. And 4 of the Palestinians inside were killed. Right away, the rumor went flying through all of Gaza that this was retribution for the death of the settler who had been stabbed. And it was one of those incidences where it was just the spark that set everything off. And kids started throwing stones in the street. It was just this incredible eruption of rage. And I think most people thought, well, you know, we've had these kinds of things before, it will certainly end, but it didn't stop. And not only did it not stop in Gaza, it got worse, and it spread to the West Bank, and to the surprise of the Israelis, it also spread to East Jerusalem, which brought it right to the Israelis' backyard. The Israelis were surprised, frankly. They were... one thing you have to understand about the situation is that even though the area here is so small, most Israelis have never seen Gaza. They have not the slightest idea of what life is like there. They don't know it because they don't want to go there. Obviously, it was dangerous. Now it's impossible almost impossible for an Israeli to go there. The only Israelis who do go there, of course, are the army and the journalists. But it was a situation where one got the feeling that, yes, we know it's horrible and we know it's awful and we know these people are living in bad conditions, but we don't really want to think about it too much, kind of out of sight, out of mind. Gaza might have, well, been halfway around the world for what most Israelis knew or cared about. And also, you have to say that considering the numbers of people involved here and considering the time that these people had spent under military occupation, it was quite an easy occupation. Certainly there would be violent incidences from time to time, a stabbing or a stoning or whatever. But again, considering the number of people involved, the Palestinian population was quite docile and quite easily occupied. So the Israelis were quite surprised. In the beginning, most of the officials, the military people, said, well, this is just something that was stirred up by outside instigators. But as time went on, it became evident that it was really, as I said before, a grassroots uprising against the occupation. I have, in order to have some idea of Palestinian life or the way Palestinians are viewed by Israelis, I've recently read a book that I commend to you. It's a very interesting one. It's called My Enemy Myself, and it's by an Israeli journalist named Yoram Binur, who, I don't know how many of you ever remember a book called Black Like Me. It was a situation where a journalist, what he did, I think, was a little more difficult than what this guy did. I mean, he passed as, he was a white man passing as a black man. And Binur is a Jew, Israeli, passing as a Palestinian. He, unlike most Israelis, knows Arabic, knows it fluently. Most Israelis don't speak Arabic at all. The only kind of communication that really goes on between Palestinians and Jews are if the Palestinians know how to speak Hebrew, and a lot of them do, simply because they have to work. But he went, he became one of these day laborers just to find out what life was like, and he has published this book, and it's quite an interesting book. It has been published in Israel. I don't know how many Israelis are going to read it. I don't know if it's been published in Hebrew. But anyway, this is what he says at the end of the book after he has masqueraded as a Palestinian, worked as a dishwasher, lived in these kind of flop houses in Tel Aviv where he stayed during the night so he wouldn't be arrested. For 20 years, the Palestinians have lived among us. During the day, we were the employers who profited by their labor and exploited them for all they were worth. In the afternoon, we were the police. In the evening, we were the soldiers at the roadblock on their way home. And finally, at night, we were the security forces who entered their homes and arrested them. While many Israelis regarded the Palestinian Arabs primarily as cheap labor and a potential security risk, the Palestinians studied Israeli society with all its characteristic weaknesses and vulnerabilities. They know exactly how the average Israeli thinks and feels. They know what is important to him and how he can be hurt. They know how to identify the military units that are sent to suppress their demonstrations and can tell which are tougher, which more lax, and what the human profile of each unit is. A curious demonstration of the intimate knowledge that the young Palestinians have of their oppressors' sore spots is the kind of insults that the children hurl at the face of soldiers who accompany a barrage of stones. The young Palestinians work in Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and other Israeli cities. They identify with the values of Israeli society at least as much as they do with their traditional backgrounds. They get a whiff of the democratic privileges that Israeli citizens enjoy, but they cannot share in them. The young man who spends his work week among a people living under democratic rule returns to his home, which is only an hour away, but which has, in fact, although not officially, been under curfew for 20 years. Any Arab who walks in the streets at a late hour can expect to be detained and questioned about his actions, even during periods of relative calm. He sees and recognizes the value of freedom, but is accorded the sort of treatment that characterizes the most backward dictatorial regimes. How can he be anything but frustrated? Again, it's just living under that kind of military occupation means that you have no say in your life. You can't vote. There is no way that you can express yourself in any other way than simply being an occupied person. I said before that we've now come to a point in the uprising where about 500, more than 500 Palestinians have been killed. About 20 Israelis have been killed. Along with those statistics go a lot of other statistics. Thousands of Palestinians have been imprisoned, usually detained without trial. Homes have been demolished. Schools have been closed. About 55 Palestinian leaders have been deported out of the country. And if anyone is interested in reading about these human rights abuses, the United States or U.S. State Department not too long ago came out with their yearly report on human rights violations. And the report on Israel was quite stern. I think the Israelis were somewhat shocked that the U.S. State Department had come down on them as hard as it did for these human rights abuses. Your home is demolished. Your home is demolished if, for example, your child may be accused of throwing stones. It's a lot of these abuses are part of a collective punishment. The Israelis know that it's really the children who are in charge of this uprising. They're the ones who are throwing the stones, and therefore they think that if they can punish the parents will be able to control the children, and so far that's been impossible. As I said, you can be detained without trial. That detention is usually 6 months. It can be, it can then be, another 6 months can be added to it. So it's a very difficult situation. And what has been happening is that the Israelis had always been able to occupy the Palestinians. Fear was a great part of their ability to exert as much control as they did. And I think if there's one thing that you see when you travel there now is a Palestinian population that is simply not afraid anymore. I felt that when just after the uprising began, there were news stories of kids, Palestinian kids, running toward the Israeli soldiers kind of, you know, tearing their shirts open and saying, shoot me, go ahead, I dare you. They had gotten to such a point where they didn't care anymore. They had nothing to lose. Their lives were at such a hopeless point that they didn't care. So the Israelis have at this point really lost that that fear factor, which helped them very much in the occupation. Oh my goodness, we have only 10 minutes left. Any questions?
After the original war.
I'm sorry?
How did they get to this point where they were had nothing to lose, because original Palestinians did have a lot. They had their homes and everything.
Well, in Gaza, they didn't. I mean, I said before, out of the 650,000 people who live in Gaza, about 430,000 of them are refugees. And they have lived in those refugee camps. Certainly, I mean, some of them were now into the second generation. There are certainly those children that were born, people who were born since 1948, have known nothing but living in a refugee camp, living with, you know, with your parents in, you know, maybe there are 8 or 10 children in the family and you're living in 2 rooms, and, you know, it's just a miserable existence. So they had gotten to the point where they honestly did believe they had nothing to lose. The effect on the Palestinians has been one that is that they are certainly more unified as a community than they've ever been before. Palestinians historically have been a very factionalized people. The Israelis, of course, have been very good at playing those factions one off against the other. They were also a people whose leadership had been not the best. And one of the reasons that that was the case is simply that the Palestinians had been a society that was rather clannish, meaning that your leader was determined because he, and in this case it would certainly be he, was a member of a certain family. He was a Husseini, or he was this, or he was that. Therefore, leadership within the community was not determined on the basis of talent or ability. It was on the basis of who you were related to. This was really tragic for the Palestinians, because at certain points in their lives, they deserved better leaders than they had. Now you see a real change, that the leadership that is coming to the fore are people who are really capable, and they are leaders who are being democratically elected. That's another thing that has not been historic reality in the lives of Palestinians. They did not, again, elect their leadership democratically, because simply it was based on family privilege. One of the things they've done is finally decide to take responsibility for themselves and for their own future. During the last 10 years of my travels in that part of the world, I've again and again heard people talk about, why doesn't the United States solve our problems? Why doesn't Europe solve our problems? Why don't the Israelis solve our problems? And finally, you see a community that has decided to take responsibility and said, if our lives are going to be better, we're going to have to take responsibility for ourselves. There's a willingness to suffer like I've not seen before in that community. Certainly there are people who are going to leave if they can, but by and large, certainly in Gaza, where there are no chances for leaving, people are saying, well, we're willing to stay here and suffer for our freedom, and we're going to have to die for it, but that's the way it's going to come about.
What are their groups?
I'm going to talk about that tomorrow or Thursday. Yeah, right. Well, there's a lot of stuff here that I didn't have a chance to get to, but I hope that at least you have some idea now how this uprising came about, how the Palestinians are located where they are, and some of the population figures and geography, and we'll go from there. The next session will be on Thursday, and that will talk about how both sides view history, their shared history from a totally different viewpoint. It's very interesting for people who have, in a sense, a lot in common. They see their histories entirely differently. Then the next session will have to do with a lot of something that I'm sure bothers a lot of Christians, and that is it possible to criticize Israel without being interpreted as an anti-Semite? And then the last session will be about what's happening politically, where the Palestinians are, where the Israelis are, where the United States is, and what the possibility for peace in the future. So, again, I'm sorry we didn't get any further than we did today, but if you have any questions and would like to stay later or ask me, I'm here in the village, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions you might have. So, thanks very much for coming.